Okay, so in this talk, there were sort of two things I wanted to explain in the title. The world, partly because you'll see there are a large number of directions that warp models can go, and partly anticipating the LHC, we are still a little bit in the dark, although I want to talk about, mostly in this talk, a little bit of review of some of those things that look like they're sort of generic features. But there's another part of the story, which is at the LHC, you will be straining to see the generic features. You may, in fact, be interested in what are the first things you're likely to see. What are going to be the easiest things or the things that you're going to have to deal with first? Let's find something, and then we can figure out what it is. Okay, so that's the first contact part of it. And my research, perhaps the part that overlaps with this title in the last few years, has probably been in the direction of things that determine your first contact with the warped world. So I don't know how much most of the audience knows, but by and large, the research in warp compactifications applied to the hierarchy problem over the last decade has been a process where the standard model, which started off in RS1 living on a brain, has sort of slowly dared to go into the pool, the bulk, and actually swims quite well there. That's the picture of this, and it's gone back and forth between various considerations of precision tests and the kind of predictive power that you'd like a theory to have. And predictive power is greatly gained by putting standard model of degrees of freedom in the bulk, and predictions which by and large go in a interesting direction, both for phenomenology, precision tests, and so on. So the quick picture and the quick slogan that I think works at first approximation, but we have to look beyond this approximation, is that you sort of let a generic five-dimensional gauge theory with gravity live in a higher dimension, the fifth dimension, say, and it's generically warped, and generically the different modes localize in interesting ways. And if the coupling strengths in five dimensions are more or less democratic, these kind of tendencies for different localization give an interesting spectrum of wave function overlaps that determine what we see in the four-dimensional theory at long distances. And by and large, that's the kind of pattern that we, qualitatively, you might, if you put your, if you think in the right way, you'd look at the data and you say, oh, I see something like that coming out of what we see in experiments. So that's the encouraging feature, okay? Everything from the hierarchy problem to Yukawa hierarchies and so on. Just to give you a sense of how chaotic I mean when I say this slogan, just take gauge boundary conditions for gauge fields in the bulk. If they're Neumann-Neumann, then they give you zero-mode gauge fields or four-dimensional gauge physics. If they're Dirichlet-Neumann, then they give you what we'd call now Higgsless breaking of four-dimensional gauge theory. If they're Neumann-Dirichlet, they give you various protective symmetries like baryon number or custodial isospin as measured by the rho or t parameters of electroweak physics. Or they can give you orbifold guts. I'll talk about that a little later. If they're Dirichlet-Dirichlet, then the fifth dimension, the fifth component of a gauge field can be a very good Higgs boson candidate, or it might show up as pseudo-Goldstone bosons or scalars at the LHC. So there's a sort of a role for all these different types of incarnations of the physics. There are some generic tendencies that gauge fields tend to not notice the warping very much, that fermions are very sensitive to their five-dimensional masses. Okay, the fermion zero modes are sensitive to five-dimensional masses. They can lean one way or the other. Higgs degrees of freedom tend to localize in the IR. So you automatically see the tendency that fermions that localize comparably to the Higgs get large Yukawa couplings. We call them heavy fermions, therefore, like the top quark. Fermions that localize sort of orthogonally far away from the Higgs tend to get small Yukawa couplings. We call them light fermions as a result. And so there's a certain amount of structure that you can read just by looking at this picture. And this picture comes out quite generically from the sort of coupled field equations of spin 0, 1, 2, half, you name it. So that's the zeroth order picture. And a part of the talk is just talking about the next approximation to this sketch. A thing to keep in mind, of course, again, a big consideration here, is that ADS-CFT, as reworked when you're in this kind of compactification of a warp space, warp compactifications, tells us that when we're studying all this physics that I just talked about on the previous slide, that this is, in a sense, a subset of studying models where you have a strongly coupled Higgs sector. That is, there's no extra dimensions, and you just have a strongly coupled Higgs sector. And the, in particular, I'm not saying whether there is a Higgs scalar in the spectrum or it's Higgsless, but the Higgs degrees of freedom, eaten by the W's and Z's or explicitly there in the spectrum, are all composite degrees of freedom. Okay, so that's the picture that we have there. And in some subset, this extra dimensional approximation becomes useful. Okay. So if you buy this picture, and you have to, this is the sort of setting for these warp compactifications. And in this context, you sort of divide into two broad categories of particles. There are elementary particles, and they're composites of the Higgs sector. So this Higgs sector is strongly coupled. One of the composites is the Higgs boson itself. That's what's solving the hierarchy problem. The Higgs is actually a composite at somewhere around the TeV scale. And the particles which are not composites, the elementary particles divorced from the Higgs sector to start with, are essentially the standard model with the Higgs removed. Okay, so that's the opening move in this game. And of course, they have to couple to each other, these two sets of degrees of freedom, in order to get masses for many of the standard model particles. And they do this in two ways. Gauge bosons from here can couple to, they can basically gauge some symmetry, some flavor symmetry of the composite sector. And so you have this kind of standard coupling to a conserved current of this sector. And the fermions, and this is what's different compared to, say, Technicolor theories, is the fermions couple linearly, so some standard model fermion couples to a fermionic operator of the strong dynamics, okay, which shares the same quantum numbers, and you can write down such an operator. This is an old proposal, but sort of overlooked to a large extent until the sort of dual description came along. And basically, the reason for Yukawa hierarchies, for example, comes from the scaling of this operator from very high scales, from the Planck scale, say, down to the weak scale. If this operator has a scaling dimension of around 5/2, then with the 3/2 of this fundamental field, you end up with something marginal and something that can survive large hierarchies. And if 5/2 plus some deviation from 5/2, say hopefully small, will give you Yukawa hierarchies when you have one of these for the left-handed fermion and one of these for the right-handed fermion in any Yukawa coupling, you will get Yukawa hierarchies of this form. So if gamma was 0, you would, at tree level, get just 1 was the going rate for a Yukawa coupling, but now you'll get Yukawa hierarchies with these kind of fractional powers of the hierarchy between the Planck scale and the Weak scale. Okay, that's the idea. It doesn't go, of course, here we know much more. These are conserved currents, so they have dimensions exactly 3. So we expect the hierarchies to appear in the fermion sector, and indeed, that's what nature provides us with. Okay, so you can ask, what would an extra-dimensional discovery, you see, we see that this warped picture is a subset of theories which are purely four-dimensional, and we don't have to talk about them on extra-dimensional terms. And in fact, in the Technicolor days, composite Higgs days, we didn't mention extra dimensions anywhere in the story. We just talked about strongly interacting Higgs sectors. And if we say that these warp compactifications are a subset of those theories, we can ask, when are we going to call it a discovery of extra dimensions as opposed to a discovery of strong dynamics for the Higgs sector? And in principle, there's a kind of limit. That's, of course, a tricky question since extra dimensional theories are going to be a subset of the whole. But there's a kind of limit where they walk and talk like extra dimensional theories. And that's, you know, if you do one of these sort of standard plots of spin versus the masses that the experimentalists discover, then this is what you mean by, I guess in an experimental sense, of discovering extra dimensions in the warped mode. you find that there are Kulitzer-Klein excitations of all the standard model particles down here. And you see that these Kulitzer-Klein excitations just have the usual spins, because they're only Kulitzer-Klein excitations. Of course, these higher dimensional theories are non-renormalizable, and at some point, you're going to have something on top of them, like string theory. Okay? And with warp factors coming into it, the string excitations are also going to be some fraction, maybe 10 times the TEV scale, maybe 50 times the TEV scale. But eventually, you're going to have string excitations with higher and higher spins, these sort of Reggi excitations kicking in. But if you have this kind of gap in spins before you start seeing the really high spins in your spectrum, then you can say, oh, there's an extra dimensional feel to the theory that we're seeing. So this is what you mean by experimentally discovering extra dimensions, I think. Right, so now, here's the point, okay? But, and I'll try to argue this for you, this is likely to be the scale on this picture, okay? So, the glass half full, there's an exciting century of research to be done, okay? And I mean it, okay? So, but, that glass half empty, the LHC is just the beginning. You're going to be stretching just to see this. Okay, and I'll try and argue briefly why, based on what considerations. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe a bunch of people here are wrong. But I'll try and say what at least is the consideration. So this waiting for the true aha, it's the extra dimensions and not just Technicolor or Technicolor Prime, is going to have to wait, in my opinion, based on this picture. There's one other consideration, though, that might allow you to think about saying it's extra dimensions right then and there at the LHC. And that comes from this so-called hard wall limit, okay? Which is to say that in this five-dimensional context, your Lagrangian is given by a theory of bulk degrees of freedom. As I said, all the degrees of freedom nowadays are being shifted into the bulk. And so you write a Lagrangian, which is also written in the bulk. But even if your degrees of freedom live in the bulk, you can always write interactions for them on these brains. Okay. Suppose you say, I don't want to write any on the brains. Okay, that's what I'm going to call the hard wall limit for this discussion. But, of course, that's not radiatively stable. So then you say, okay, I concede. I'm going to write the minimal radiatively stable terms allowed, or at least the going rate for these interactions, is sort of the minimal radiatively stable size. Then it turns out that this setup is actually rather predictive. First of all, it's technically natural, it's radiatively stable by definition. And it's an interesting limit because there are a number of calculations you can do which actually predict relations even at the lowest KK level. Okay, you don't have to see 3 KK levels before you start to say this is extra dimensions. You can actually do calculations which depend on the extra dimensional description being quantitatively correct, which allow you to say some relations between, for example, the mass of the spin 1 KK mode and the spin 2 KK mode, things like that, okay? Well, the people who play around with this know there are roots of Bessel functions you get and so on. And the reason you can trust them in this hard wall limit is, is because you really have extra dimensions here and not just a strongly coupled Higgs vector. So there is some level of predictivity, but while it's an interesting limit, if you asked a string theorist, for example, they might say something like this, if something like this were to happen, the fifth dimension may not look like this, an interval. It may well look more like this, a lot of other extra dimensions, a lot of other junk in the game. And so it's unlikely that you're going to have your hard wall limit to play with, and I think we should be fully prepared for that possibility. That is, it's nice to have a calculable game, but it's nice to agree with nature too. Now, even here, I would say, there are limits of this kind of picture that are possible in my mind's eye, knowing what I know about string theory, which is something, but not too much. And the hard wall limit is, in a sense, still a possibility. I just don't think it is by any means guaranteed that you're going to be that lucky to have these sort of calculable relations between Kulitzer-Klein excitations at the LHC. Okay, so you might ask, what is the value added of having this sort of warped extra-dimensional picture of the strong dynamics? It doesn't seem to be brilliantly predictive and so on. And I think part of the value added is that you have an effective field theory to tie your hands to some extent as you're trying to escape all sorts of crises. You're constrained by warped effective field theory, and it is a useful check of your ideas. It's effective field theory because this is higher dimensional gauge theory, and so of course it's non-normalizable. The warped has teeth because the cutoff is being warped down, if you like. The cutoff imposed by being a non-normalizable theory effectively is warped across the extra dimensions. And in some sense, the warped effective field theory has a very interesting sort of domain of validity, which is, it certainly is just a regular effective field theory. It describes everything, all the processes you want, at energies below the lowest value of this cutoff, okay, the warped down cutoff. But it actually also describes some set of processes, I'll crudely call them inclusive processes, even below the warped up cutoff, some Planckian scale. Okay, so it's got an interesting range of things, and it turns out that many processes of interest to us, like gauge coupling unification, you might want to know about this. Okay, whereas processes of the LHC, you might want to know about this range. And both of them seem to be covered by what is calculable in warped effective field theory. The trouble is, the small parameters that you're expanding in, again, I want to stress, are not too small. This is not like QED. If you sort of plug in experimental values of the four-dimensional gauge couplings and use the relation to five dimensions, then you can figure out sort of how many KK modes can you describe before the theory sort of breaks down in the UV due to non-renormalizability. And let me, for lack of time, cut the story short. When you put in loop corrections and all the other sophisticated things you can think of, you find that your expansion parameter is well, this is one way of phrasing it, how many KK modes before, you know, the theory breaks down and you need string theory or whatever to take over. And it's very few. Another way to say it is your expansion parameter is 1 over a small handful, you know, 1 over 3 or something. The expansion parameter. It's not great, but it's all we have. So for me, I'm still used to doing K-on effective field theory at some point, and K-on chiral Lagrangians, I should say, and so this does not totally phase me. But for some people, this is a shock that the expansion parameter is so poor in that sense. In the face of all these things that you don't know, I don't know the shape of whatever ends the IR brain and however many extra dimensions I really have and so on, the question is what tools do you have to push at the LHC, okay? And one idea, and I think the idea for quick reconnaissance, first contact, not for the final analysis, but first contact, is this idea that these first set of authors here call little m theory, which is the following set of relations, okay? So ultimately, we're studying some strongly interacting Higgs sector. By ADS-CFT, if we're lucky, it has an extra-dimensional description. And if you have that, by latticizing the extra dimension, you can break your continuous extra-dimensional theory into some set of four-dimensional sectors coupled together. And if you do this very crudely, a very crude discretization of the extra dimension, you'll get some sort of little Higgs-like structure, which you might then relate back using the old-fashioned language of vector meson dominance to the strongly interacting theory this way. But this is a very useful way of proceeding, partly because it only involves a four-dimensional theory with a number of sectors in it. In that sense, it's geared up for both computation and also just the speed of thought. It's hard to do calculations in curved space in higher dimensions. It's easy to think about four-dimensional theories coupled in very simple ways. And this is the way that I'm going to talk about this version of ours of doing this. But it's not just the sort of minimal little Higgs theories that go by that name. It contains excitations that you might normally not talk about, like, for example, lepton excitations or gluon excitations, which all come from the higher dimensional picture, but are not part of what is normally called little Higgs theory. if you take that viewpoint, it's useful to see how the phenomenology, what does it even look like, and what is the structure of these little Higgs theories, and perhaps to compare them with supersymmetric theories, which are kind of our default of new physics. So these are the minimal kind of, the most coarse-grained picture of this kind of physics is a kind of two-sector model, okay? And it really is a very simple kind of construction compared to the fully warped models. And it's very flexible in that it allows you to think about all those different variants of the warp theories that one could contemplate. And it's very fast and simple to think in terms of, and therefore ultimately designed for first contact with warped data, okay? So the structure of these theories is very simple. There's two sectors. Not surprisingly, I'll just call it elementary and composite, but composite is just the origins. You're really saying this is a second, let me talk about this sector first. This is just a standard model with the Higgs removed, these elementary particles. You know what these couplings look like. It's a standard model. And they're typified by some order one couplings, G, okay? Gauge couplings, basically, is all that's left in the standard model if you throw away the Higgs. So here are some order one gauge couplings and their massless gauge fields and chiral fermions if you've removed the Higgs. Here is a kind of a copy, I'll call it a Dirac copy of the standard model. It's really where you're putting the Kaluza-Klein excitations, almost. It consists of massive gauge fields and massive Dirac fermions, okay, with some masses which are of order TeV. We'll figure out what the bounds are in a second. The couplings, however, are stronger. And the reason is they inherit their life from the sort of five-dimensional gauge couplings, which are not the same as the four-dimensional gauge couplings. They differ by these volume factors. Well, it's actually the radius of the curvature radius in the extra dimensions. So there are stronger couplings here, weaker couplings here, two completely divorced sectors, except that you have to allow this kind of mixing, mass mixing terms. So all of the particles here can mix with their excited counterparts, and only after you do mass diagonalization do you actually have the physical states. For gauge bosons, this mixing is sort of some order one effect, but for the fermions, it's very hierarchical. And the reason is it's a remnant of those effects of those anomalous dimensions gamma I was talking about. The fact that fermions can lean one way or the other in the extra dimension very sensitively dependent on the 5D parameters means that this mixing mass can be very small or order one, okay? So this is, if you can sort of, I think many of you can glue together these Lego blocks in your head and easily guess the kind of physics that we're going to be doing. I'll quickly sketch some of that in a second. But you can compare it with supersymmetry, say with our parity, where the standard model couplings are, look exactly the same, and this is the kind of new vertex that you have where the standard model fermions can pair produce the new particles, which are typically light. Precision tests come in two sorts. There's the flavor tests. Here, for example, is something that would give rise to KK-bar mixing. These things, again, the glass half full is to say that if you have new physics at a roundabout a TeV, or even if it's 10 TeV, and you exchange it in a chaotic flavor chaotic theory, then normally you'd have to take the masses of the new physics to 1,000 TeV or at least hundreds of TeV in order to avoid the stringent tests on flavor changing neutral currents. Here you kind of get an automatic gym mechanism. Basically, the small mixing angles that correlate with light fermions automatically buy you a great deal of suppression so that the going rate is only of order 10 TeV, but whether it's 10 TeV or 3 TeV or 1 TeV or 50 TeV makes a huge difference to your observability. And I'll cut short a discussion, but it's an interesting discussion, to just say, I don't know what the answer is. I know that these are the kinds of tensions that this whole scenario has. It has a number of precision tests in which you can agonize at the level of, is it 10 TeV, or is it 50 TeV, or is it 3 TeV? And there are a number of interesting directions to go, and the parameters are not locked in stone, and you can hide, and so on. But it is a worry. that this scenario is, if it's correct, that the new physics is actually pushed out of the LHC range, it's possible that we're missing one trick here or there. I think in the morning we heard what some of these ideas are that might actually make it really within the LHC grasp. So flavor precision tests really have teeth in this game. The standard things to worry about are things like electroweak precision tests, and they in this game are not quite so bad. I mean, we can understand them, and many of the considerations are actually well worked out and easy to consider, and there are not too many free parameters to hide in, and we get reasonable bounds which say 2 or 3 TeV. So the electroweak precision tests are saying that the physics is around 2 or 3 TeV or heavier, and other kinds of flavor tests are, I would say, ultimately less conclusive, but far more worrying. That is, if you just generically look around in the parameter space, you would say maybe we should be ruled out above 10 TeV. And if you, but there are certainly ansatzes and new ideas that can bring all of that down to 3 TeV. Okay, so this one, in particular, zeta BB bar, says that the two halves of a top Yukawa coupling are not equally shared. The bottom left is a partner of top left, and the fact that that is well tested tells us that the top right has more of the mixing than the top left to the Higgs sector. So much mixing, in fact, that you might as well consider it part of the Higgs sector. And I'll come back to that in 1 second, but here are the interesting, some of the interesting channels, okay? There are channels where you have excited heavy flavor being produced and then de-exciting, which are a little bit like little Higgs. There are channels which are not like little Higgs, where, for example, you produce Kaluza-Klein gluons and you watch them decay into top quarks, and that's challenging but perhaps doable depending on the masses of these guys. There's the spin 2 graviton, which is an interesting thing if you can see it. You might say, how do I know it's not just some hadron of strong dynamics? How do I know it's extra dimensions? And I just lower the bar and say, look, all of these other things, you might not even be producing composites. You might just be producing some new gauge structure at the TeV scale, okay? Whereas if you produce spin 2, massive spin 2, you're either producing a composite or you're seeing into extra dimensions, either of which is totally revolutionary, okay? So that's interesting. This kind of two-sector model or two-site model I'm describing allows you to study many, many nooks and crannies with great ease and insight. Here's one that I don't think has been explored any other way, which is producing an excited Z, which can, in this case, decay into pairs of excited leptons, and therefore have several leptons in the final state. I see Graham is looking at his watch, so I should say, much of the thinking in terms of first contact is maybe you don't even see the new physics directly at the KK scale. You see little implications of it. And I think the work of these guys is interesting in this direction. Here is where the new physics is in some sense virtually correcting properties of the Higgs boson. And certainly precision measurement, to the extent one can do it at the LHC, and certainly at my LC, would be very important in spotting compositeness in the Higgs boson properties. The Higgs can actually be more massive. I don't think I see a model in the literature which realizes this generic possibility, but if you look at composite corrections to the quartic of the Higgs self coupling, comparing it with SUSY, it can easily be larger, suggesting that it is possible to have a larger Higgs mass. Okay, again, in terms of tuning, one thing I'd say is, okay, tuning is cut off by the scale of the new physics. In SUSY, if you have high scales, sort of messenger scale or whatever, high scale models, you'd also have logs making for more tuning. These models don't have these logs. That is, having 2 or 3 TeV scale resonances is not some incredibly fine-tuned model, generically speaking, okay? That's all I'm trying to say here. So you can also generalize these ideas to putting a more unified theory, gauge theory, in the bulk, and you can just play the game of orbifold guts, except now it's warped orbifold guts and non-supersymmetric, okay? And it works surprisingly well, okay? And I gave a seminar last time for an hour and a half on that topic. I won't repeat it. Why would you care? Because these warped orbifold guts actually contain certain exotic partners of the top quark, because the top quark is, after all, now considered a composite. Some of these would show up as, say, the neutrino-like partner of the top quark can actually have quantum numbers given to it by baryon number, the need to have proton stability, that can allow it to appear as a kind of missing energy signal in at the LHC, and possibly a dark matter candidate, as argued by these guys. Another possibility, another generically light state in this kind of unified setup, is the colored partner of the ordinary Higgs, which again would be light for the same reason that the ordinary Higgs is light, with color corrections giving it a mass of, say, several hundred GeV. Several hundred GeV is better than several TeV. And again, depending on exactly how you preserve baryon number, these kinds of processes are possible for producing this kind of colored Higgs. So it's kind of these incidental features that might make for some light particles, the crumbs from the table that the LHC is able to access. And we might, no time left, stop. Yes, okay, so here, let me see if I can ignore this. Yes, I think I can ignore this if I can just say that one of the interesting ideas that I think in the present context goes back to Pomerang and Gurgetta is the idea that supersymmetry might actually live in the bulk, even if it's broken at the highest possible scales, the Planck scale, that it might survive in some way down to the IR brain. And that turns out, I believe, to be a plausible story. If I'm a string theorist for a second, top-down guy, I find that actually makes a plausible case, a plausible story for how these warped compactifications might appear in nature, with Susie attached accidentally, technically speaking. We revisited this, a student of mine and myself, and again, this matters. Why? Because the composite particles, the lightest composite, the Higgs and the top, would then have superpartners, whereas all the other particles would not. So it would not be a full complement of superpartners which are light, and that would affect the phenomenology. For example, here you could produce a stop and watch it decay into a Higgsino and a top, for example. The Higgsinos, the neutral ones, could be a source of missing energy. It would be. And possibly even a dark matter candidate, but we haven't studied that. Okay, Graham, you're cutting me off, and I'm done. Thank you.
All right, we have time for lots of questions. I'll give out a mic for those who want to ask.
Have you thought of the implications of removing your hard wall to a soft wall?
I guess I just only the other day heard a sort of technical meaning to the word soft wall. So maybe could you just tell me what you mean by soft wall? Because I was kind of looking at soft. I can tell you what I mean by soft wall, but I better understand the sense of your question.
In the sense of Tony's Gurgetta soft wall.
Yeah, so I only just heard it, and he didn't give that talk, even though it was the advertised topic. Since I can't quite remember that definition, I'm going to give a slightly, maybe it's the same thing, or a more general version of that, which is that here's a way of faking a soft wall. That is, it matches many other ways that I can imagine a soft wall coming about. Imagine you have a scalar field that lives in the bulk, and it has a tadpole on the IR brain, so that it has a profile that looks like this, okay? Then it will back react, for example, on the geometry. You can also couple to it, so it can vary. You can have a phi-dependent coupling for gauge theory in the bulk, things like that. It's exactly because I find that, because I find that so eminently plausible, why shouldn't junk like this, I'm taking a chaotic view, it should be there, that it would affect all of the nicely arranged couplings of the hard wall limit that give it its beautiful calculability. But the ability to capture all of that is contained in these kind of two-site models, where the parameters of the two-site four-dimensional theory are floating. And you mostly constrain them by the incredible body of precision tests we already have, rather than constraining them by some theoretical hard wall limit. So I have thought about it, and that's why I take more this two-site bottom-up approach to the subject.
So in the four-dimensional little Higgs model building, one of the interesting ideas was the steep parity, which allowed to relax precision electroweak constraints and, at least ignoring flavor, allowed to bring a lot of kind of rich phenomenology to the LHC scales. Given this connection between warp world and little Higgs that you mentioned, is there a natural implementation of this kind of parity in warp models?
I have a glancing familiarity with Kaustub et al.'s, attempts to do something like that. And maybe there are some other people who have tried. But my quick impression, and he can correct me, is it seems like maybe you could do it, but it doesn't seem so automatic. The story I've been telling you here really lives according to this this advertisement here, the slogan, that 90% of what is going right in this model is coming for free from the fact that it's just amazing. You do generic things in 5D, and they give you things that look a little bit like features of the standard model. I don't see that with the T-parity thrown in, but I see that maybe we're not looking at it right yet or something, so I don't want to say anything definitive. I don't see a natural T-parity model emerging here. I don't know a way of thinking about T-parity which makes it kind of a good high-energy theory truly high-energy, which makes it really attractive and grabs you.
Can you say a little bit more about what you rushed through at the end there about supersymmetry in the bulk?
Yeah. Forget whether I paid you to ask that question so I could finish my talk. But anyway, just briefly. It's an interesting idea. Look, string theory seems to come with supersymmetry. If you're having some stringy completion, the reason I agonize about this is I say, if I look at SUSY, it's also an effective theory that eventually there's gravity, eventually there's a UV completion. But string theory gives us a kind of at least a cartoon, and they're pretty good cartoons, of how something like the MSSM could emerge from a truly fundamental theory. But all of these effective warped models don't have that. They don't have that, gold star rating or something. So why not? Why don't they? And so if you ask, why hasn't any string theorist really satisfied the full checklist of the kinds of models I'm talking about, where SUSY is not playing the front seat role? Well, you say, maybe we should look. Maybe we should see why not. So you take some generic SUSY theory in the bulk, which you could imagine coming out of some superstring theory, and you say, what goes wrong? And when supersymmetry is in the bulk, you find that there is an obstruction to having a large hierarchy. And if I back up one slide, I'll show you what that is. I told you that 5D chaos gives you something good, gives you something looks like the real world. That's a lie. There's one generic possibility that kills it. If you have a scalar tachyon in the bulk, tachyons in the bulk in ADS, they don't have to be an instability of anything. They don't have to be a sign of any instability. The curvature fixes everything up. But such tachyons do represent an instability, as Matt knows perfectly well, so I'm just going to say this for everybody else's benefit. They do represent an instability in the presence of a Planck brain. These tachyons, if they have some tadpole interaction on the Planck brain, get sourced, they actually grow, they don't die off, they grow in the infrared, they back react on the geometry eventually, and you get a singularity or something equally bad, cutting off the space and cutting off the hierarchy from where you want it to go. Okay? So this is the bad thing. Now I come to the second point, which is it turns out that the superpartners of gauge fields in the bulk, the superpartners of gauge fields in the bulk are exactly such tachyons. Okay? So you have these, as soon as you say supersymmetry and add it to this whole story I told you, boom, you're hitting the problem of tachyons in the bulk. And there is a way of controlling them, and again, Matt did study a unappreciated, less appreciated paper, but I appreciate it, this paper where he used an existing string theory, ADS5 cross S5, or if you like, it's dual N equals 4, Suzy Yang Mills, to explore some of these issues, where one of the things you can observe is that if you have enough symmetry that you can insist on, not supersymmetry, but some other symmetry, you could actually forbid this tadpole term in the first place. But if you try to do that in a phenomenologically correct context, and that's what we were trying to do here, it means that you're forced to unify your model beyond the standard model. You're forced to have some sort of non-abelian unification, and this is the minimal one we could think of, in the bulk. And it has to be intact down to the IR scale. And basically, with non-abelian symmetries, if you insist, any superpartner of a gauge field is an adjoint of one of these non-abelian symmetries. And if it's an adjoint of these symmetries, then these symmetries themselves can stop you from writing a tadpole on the Planck brain. That's the story we studied in this context. Having set that up, I should just ask Matt again, was there something specific that you, is there a step two to the question?
No.
You probably know everything I just said except the fact that
the
I
last
chose
piece.
This particular.
Yeah, okay, that's cool.
Okay, so I think we'll thank Raman again. Our next speaker is